Good morning. How are you guys today? Good. I just want to introduce myself. I'm Courtney. I'm over Gwinnett Church. I'm the campus lead over there. My Gwinnett peeps, awesome. Thank you. I just have another giveaway for you guys this morning. It is an actual Stretch Armstrong doll and movie tickets. So if you were a fan, this is an all skate, so everyone can play. Has anyone ever actually sweat to the oldies with Richard Simmons? Really? Okay, so two hands. How long has it been? The most recent Jazzercise Richard Simmons experience? 2 years? 3 years. Anybody more recent than 2 years? You're gonna be fun later. All right, so you can come get your prize. So movie tickets and Stretch Armstrong, you within 2 years, right? Yeah, that's awesome. Congratulations. All right. So next, I would love to introduce Tammy Reed. She's here from the state office to speak to us about RPPS. At any time during, if you would text questions, oh, sorry, there's my giant dog in my family, by the way. We'll have a text to number up on the screen, and at any point, there we go, you guys can just text your questions, and we'll have some Q&A time at the end.
Okay, can you guys hear me? So my name is Tammy Reed. I am standing before you, the living and breathing representative of the DFACS state office, and how does that make you feel? I think that I was chosen on purpose to come and talk to you guys because I think what you'll find is I might not be the stereotype of kind of what you would imagine a DFACS state office person to be. I actually hope that that's the case if you feel a little leery of us. But I do want to talk about stretching within the system. And I'm going to talk a little bit, but this won't be like your kind of standard lecture or training. So you'll notice that I don't have PowerPoint. I don't intend to have a PowerPoint. I'm going to ask you guys a couple of level-setting questions before we get into it. And then what I really want to do is just have the opportunity for us to have some dialogue. So I really encourage you to use that text questions option. I have a silent, who's not going to be so silent, co-presenter. I just told her this morning she was my co-presenter. So Leslie Reese will join me in a little while, and she will help me to dialogue around your questions. But also, Leslie and I have really been on quite a long journey, I'll tell you about, to stretch our system through reasonable and prudent parenting. And so she and I find usually when we have conversations, she's able to also challenge and inspire me to think about things differently or to answer a question maybe more deeply or fully. So I'll be asking her to kind of join me after I give you kind of the overview so that she can help us get to some depth, really, as we enter into your questions. So let me just do a couple of level-setting questions. If you will raise your hand if you are currently fostering. Excellent. Respite families, if you're currently doing respite. Excellent. How about relatives? Do we have some relative caretakers with us today? Okay, and then supporting mentors. We have some supporting mentors with us today. Okay, excellent. So I wanted to kind of get a sense of who we're talking about. I'll try my best to tailor some remarks to the audience and not be the typical state office talking head. You can call me out if you think I am. I'll adjust. And so then also, raise your hand if you feel like you have a moderate level of understanding of reasonable and prudent parenting. Moderate level. Okay. High level. Okay. And then lower level understanding. Okay. So we're working with mostly moderate level understanding. And a little few high and a few low. So what I want to tell you is that beyond this dialogue that we're going to have today, there are lots of other materials about reasonable and prudent parenting, lots of additional details, but I really am going to focus today not so much on the rules, although the rules are a part of it, but on the why behind reasonable and prudent parenting and on our stretching journey with using reasonable and prudent parenting to improve the quality of life for your families. And I mean families in a very large and broad sense of the word. So I will tell you a bit about myself, and that some of the things that I will tell you are because I'm going to try to use some of my agency experience with a particular foster family and some of their kids to drill down into some real life examples of how our PPS might impact a situation. And hopefully that'll give you a good sense of where we're trying to go and the why behind it. And so in July the 1st of this year will be my 26th year with the division. So I've been with the division for a very, very long time. And like most people at the division, not all but most, I started out as a line case manager. And so I was a line case manager for 5 years before I moved into supervision. Beyond supervision, I've done lots of things. I've been a consultant for various and sundry different types of programs. I've administered some regional programs, including our work with our foster parents, resource development. I've been a regional director in Region 4, which is kind of Carroll County, Spalding County, Henry County, that area. And then I came to our state office about 2.5 years ago. And I came to our state office about 2.5 years ago under duress, very significantly under duress for a couple of reasons. And so one is a base physical and logistical reason. I live at the Alabama line. And so I drive from the Alabama line in Carroll County and West Carroll County to Peachtree Street, which is right at the Five Point SMARTA station in Atlanta. And so that's quite a haul every day. And I wasn't so excited about that. And the second reason is even within the field where sometimes you see a bit more flexibility in the division, I was probably considered to be like a rebellious person or a rebel with a cause and sometimes without a cause that you could know about. I don't know. And so the thought of going to the state office where you really work a tremendous amount with federal regulations and state statutes and laws and all the different books of policies was rather daunting to me, and I did not think it would be that interesting. And so there was a person who was really recruiting me, several people actually, and trying to get me to come. And so, you know, their biggest pitch to me was, we really want a revolution at the state office in many ways, and we want a culture shift. And so we want a culture shift from more of the risk-averse, very conservative, rule-bound, perhaps, way that we operate. And I've learned a tremendous amount about why that culture exists, to more of a willingness to experience greater balance between assuring safety and creating policies and practices that are for 159 counties, 14,000 children, about 7,000 or 8,000 foster families at any given point in time. So a balance between rules for the masses and allowances for considering individual situations, right? So those are hard to manage. And so I went to the state office. It's been a super interesting 2.5 years. But I really find that a lot of my thought process still goes back to line case management days. So I want to tell you a little bit about that and about a particular foster family and a few of their kids, although they had many more. So I've started in a very tiny county called Harrelson County, also in West Georgia, in 1993, I think is right. And I had come from Atlanta. I'd always lived in larger cities. I'd lived in Charlotte, North Carolina, in D.C., and in Atlanta. And Harrelson County was like landing on a different planet. I mean, it really was. And so I had landed on a different planet in very rural Harrelson County. And although I had gone to school, I have a couple of degrees in psychology, actually, not in social work. So I'd gone to school, and I thought I knew some things. But I am the epitome of your brand new, very green case manager who really doesn't know very much, and you're continually having to train, right? So that was certainly me. One of my foster families, their names were Tom and Kathy. Lots of foster families in Harrelson County, of course, at the time. And it was a very different environment because we wouldn't have had access to the internet. We wouldn't have had a regular access to computers. We didn't have cell phones, none of that. So a lot of learning and teaching was occurring when I would go and, of course, sit right down in Tom and Kathy's living room, right? So they taught me a tremendous amount. And looking back, particularly around reasonable and prudent parenting, I'm just thinking about a few ways that perhaps Tom and Kathy's life might have been different if some of these principles and the whys behind them had come into play at the time. I want to talk along the way as we talk about the policies about three kids of theirs in particular. So I also think that there are some ways that these kids' lives may have been impacted differently, and it's what I'm striving for in the stretching of the way we operate the system. So they would be Kelly, who is the oldest, and when I came to work at DFAC, she was already placed with Tom and Kathy. She was 15 years old. And Gina, who I removed. In a small county, you really do everything, which has been a blessing. I'm glad for that, but I removed her from her birth family, who lived way back in the woods, off the grid, in a really small camper. So there was kind of that whole dynamic, which, of course, I had not had much experience with either. And so I placed her with Tom and Kathy when she was about 12 years old. And then Robbie, who came from the hospital. I also removed him. He was in the hospital at the time as a newborn, and once he was medically stable enough, he was released to Tom and Kathy's house with all his tubes and all his monitors and all the beeping that went on with him. And so here's the first thing that I think RPPS would have done for us all at the time. We were pretty rule-bound back then, right? So in my eyes, like literally the only person who could take care of Robbie with his high-level medical needs was Kathy. Like I might have been mortified at the idea that Kathy thought she had an idea, and I'm just being really transparent, of somebody else who could take care of him, and I really didn't need to know anything about it. Like, that probably would have scared me. I think what's important to remember in reflection about that is it probably would have scared me because I was scared. Kathy and I just had a very recent conversation about the fact that when he first came to her house for several visits, I would say, I would not hold him. Because I was afraid that I would just dislodge one of his tubes, and I'm 23 years old probably. I would dislodge one of his tubes, or I would make his alarm go off. And so in hindsight, and being slightly older now, and Kathy and Tom having taught me a tremendous amount, what I would say is probably sometimes our tendency at the division to be quite rule-bound or risk-averse comes from an insecurity of our own. This is particularly true perhaps with our line case managers who don't have a tremendous amount of life experience. Sometimes. And so one way I think right off the bat RPPS would have changed Kathy and Robbie's life, particularly Kathy, who was the primary caretaker, is that she would just have had the freedom to teach me and coach me in which of her family members and support systems that she had all the confidence in the world in to take care of him, understanding his own particular needs and the skill set of her support system. And she would have just taught me, like she did in so many other ways, right into a comfort level with that process. She didn't really have that option at the time, right? because they had to be checked and they had to be screened. And probably at the time, if, you know, she had multiple, if she had the wonderful blessing to have multiple caretakers and support people available, we would have started saying, well, why can't she take care of him? You know what I mean? So, like, I think it would have helped in that way. So I want to introduce them to you. I'll talk more about them as I move along. So the reasonable and prudent parenting standard, and this is the maybe boring part but necessary, actually came about via some federal legislation in 2014, and it was a part, oddly, of some laws around sex trafficking, but wasn't really about sex trafficking. This happens. I've learned a lot about how laws are made. We're in legislative session now. I've learned a lot about how laws are made. But the second part to that was the Strengthening Families Act, and the whole point to that was what? Was to normalize the experience of people, all kinds of people who were experiencing the child welfare system. And so in Georgia, we then passed Senate Bill 138, which codified here in Georgia all of the reasonable and prudent parenting standards, along with youth rights and responsibility standards. Those two walked quite along and aligned together. We did that in 2015. And again, the goal was normalcy. It applies to everybody. So it applies to all youth in foster care, all foster families, irrespective of whether you work with a public or private agency or any particular county. It applies to all of our congregate care settings. And that's a particular area of difficulty navigating that I think we're trying to stretch on. So it really, really applies to everybody. There's nobody exempt. Having said there's nobody exempt, I will say that each and every case, and this makes perfect sense to you guys, I know, rests on its own merits, right? So every kid is a unique and fabulous individual, and so we'll have different needs and requirements in terms of supplemental caregiving. I actually want to deviate and talk about youth rights first. We are not going to go into youth rights significantly in our talk today, but I do think that some of these youth rights really form the basis of what both the federal government and our larger Georgia system is trying to get accomplished through reasonable and prudent parenting and the youth rights and responsibilities. So there's lots of them, but just in brief, youth, and this is all youth, have the right to fair and equitable treatment by DFACs, foster parents, and other partners, the right to information about their heritage and their background, the right to know why they are in the child welfare system, the right to have their educational, health, and mental health needs met, the right to family and community connections, and I want to talk about how that looks broadly, the right to have regular ongoing opportunities to engage in developmentally appropriate activities, so extracurriculars and all that kind of stuff, the right to have intensive ongoing efforts to reunify them with their birth family, the right to participate in the development of case plans at an age-appropriate level, the right to participate in court proceedings and have a voice, the right to receive services needed to help them transition to adulthood, where that becomes their reality in the child welfare system. And then there are several more that are really all about our teens in the independent living section that are about they need to have their Social Security cards, they need to have their IDs, they need to have Social Security benefits if it's appropriate that they should receive those, and we should gather those for them. I say all that to say the youth rights section kind of forms the basis for what we're trying to accomplish in RPPS in an odd way. And it is in this way. We want to make a paradigm shift to the idea, and this is an old concept, nothing new to any of us, but the idea that the village is broad and vast and diverse, and that all of us, regardless of our backgrounds and experiences, require a village. We require connections with other human beings above and beyond, by far, just our primary caretakers. And we require them in complexity versus silos. So for children in foster care, if you get what I mean, you know that they have birth family, right? And so there's all that dynamic. And so we owe it to them to work very, very hard to maintain connections so that they understand their birth family identity, kind of where I come from, why I'm here now. And then they are in a foster family environment where they acclimate to new people. They get very close and bonded to those new people. And indeed, that is their second family in the village, right? So you guys know this. I'm preaching to the choir. But within the second family in the village, they really should not be operating in a different way from any other child in the village. And so we recognize federally and here within the state of Georgia that far too often our kids who are experiencing foster care are having a different experience from the other kids that they're looking at in their family. And that has a lot to do with us as a system, and we're responsible for changing that. So we want them to develop connections that are within their second family in their village. And then sometimes it stops right there. Maybe they return to their first family in the village. Maybe they stay with their second family in the village for permanency. And then all too often, you know, we continue to make hops, which is what we don't want to see, because you're asking your youth to really move to a new country, so to speak, every time that there's a move. So the idea is that we are empowering through reasonable and prudent parenting caregivers to make reasonable decisions, just everyday parenting decisions, rather than having to navigate this complex and very rule-bound system process to authorize you guys to do things that you would normally do in the day-to-day. So that's the idea between RPPS. It is a journey. So we started it in 2015. We wrote some rules. We wrote some guidelines. We've been testing them out. We've been hearing from you guys what's been working and what hasn't been working. So this is really our next iteration of reasonable and prudent parenting, and it will continue as you test it out and you live it and then tell me how it's working for you and how it's not working for you. I want to go back to kind of the one size does not fit all mentality and a couple of points made about the village and the multiple families that the child might experience in a village. So I already mentioned that for Robbie at Tom and Kathy's house, there would be some particular considerations that Tom and Kathy would make when they had a caretaker take care of Robbie, right? Now, they wouldn't want to leave Robbie with me by myself at first, I'm sure, because I had a little bit of hesitancy around being sure I wouldn't hurt him. I mean, that was the basic thing. But there's tons of family members that watch them do this every day, all day, that they could have called on and would have been able to do it. And indeed, after some time, I could have kept him like a pro by myself, but Kathy had to coach me into that. For Kelly, if you'll recall, she was 15 when I first met her. It was a very different time, and Kelly had family, birth family. Her mom was deceased. Her father was in prison for life, but she had lots and lots of aunts and uncles and lots and lots and lots of cousins and lots and lots and lots of brothers and sisters. All in care in other counties. And so looking back, through the power of social media, I'm in contact with each of these people that I'm going to talk about on Facebook. They found me. And so for Kelly, and I've had some lunches with Kelly, who probably is the person that struggles the most out of this family system. She's very, very, very connected to her birth family. Very connected to her birth family now as an adult and as a mother. And she has an aunt that she's particularly close to. And looking back, I think Kathy and Tom probably could have mentored and coached her aunt and uncle, and she could have been with them. And even if she didn't live with them, they probably would have been better mentors for her and understood her better as she moved into adulthood had we allowed them and Tom and Kathy to develop relationship. And so in that way, extend a support system that was healthy and appropriate for Kelly. So that's a paradigm shift I see there that actually relates to birth family connections and the idea of partnership parenting, but also relates to individualizing to every specific case. Because we have to make a team decision together, right? What is appropriate in partnership parenting? How far are we all comfortable in going? What are the boundaries? But I think it can really apply in some ways to RPPS. We also want to do some elimination of barriers where we can to kids participating in extracurricular activities, right? This actually goes further than you think, and I'm going to go back to Tom and Kathy's kids. So, you know, you kind of think, oh, okay, they want to do an extracurricular, fine. They can do it. They could do it before RPPS. We don't have to deal with that, right? But I think about Gina, who played softball. She played softball a good bit. And so Tom and Kathy worked. Their town was not particularly close to her schools, neither her middle school nor her high school. And there was nobody around that could make sure that Gina got back and forth to practice. And so here's what happened one year. And it took us quite some time, because she was a relatively quiet girl and not the most open, to understand what had gone on. Suddenly she said she didn't want to play. So, you know, we were trying to find out why she didn't want to play, you know, encouraging her. She was really good. So, you know, you're so talented at it. Here's what was really going on, but we were well into the season. She didn't get to play that year because of this. She felt the stress of the limited number of people in her life, probably primarily Tom and Kathy, but also me, who was trying to do a lot of the taking her back and forth at the time, that she was causing a problem for us. She was a burden in some way. And so in her 12-year-old mind, she could solve that problem. And she wouldn't have to risk moving or leaving, which she was always really kind of scared about, by simply stopping. So in today's world, in RPPS, right, we should have like an explosion of possibilities for being able to get Gina back and forth around softball. And not just to transport her, because that's the least of it, but we could explode the number of people in the bleachers. She was really, really good. It was fun to see her play. I think there was probably lots of people in Tom and Kathy's family that would have loved to do that, that I never really encouraged to come and bring that level of support. So, just another example of how it plays out in unexpected ways. And so we have a few responsibilities, both DFACs, CPAs, and CCIs, in making sure that you are empowered to do RPPS. And where we don't do this well, and it's frustrating to you guys, is something that I'm continually, from my little one person's position, trying to heavily impact, because it makes such a difference. You have to know the child's information. And you have to know it in enough depth to be able to then match your child to your support system and all the things that they could do to become an engaged part of your child's village. We have to ensure that you guys are well matched to the extent possible, that you're well trained, which is kind of why I'm here today, to have more of a dialogue. I can't know from sitting at 2 Peachtree each day what needs to happen that will work best for you guys. So I have to be in dialogue with you guys. And this one is really interesting, but extremely true in what we're really trying to push on. The agency or department may not create rules, standards, or policies which limit, prevent, or create barriers to caregivers making reasonable and prudent parenting decisions within the boundaries that are already set forth. So where the collective we, the business we, so that's DFACs and all of our county offices, but also our state office, all of our CPAs, all of our CCIs, where we as the business do that, probably with the best of intentions, actually. We have to hear your voice back, that that's happening so we can shift and make adjustments so that normalizing your life and the lives of your kids goes as smoothly as possible. There are a couple of specifics that I want to mention about our PPS because these are kind of the stretching areas. There has been this debate. These are areas of kind of debate or confusion, which I'm going to try to make clear, but Leslie probably will help me make much more clear. But so there are a few of these, and one is around, do you have to document and do you have to tell us as you make our PPS decisions? So look at it in this way, because this is how we intend for this communication to be done. It is not a rule that you have to write down every time you do an RPPS. It is not a rule that you have to call us every time you do an RPPS activity, whether it's extracurriculars or expanding your support network for the child or anything like that. The idea is that when I come to see you at your house every month, right, and we're sitting down and we're talking about everything that's gone on in that month and things that have happened in the case, that you're just telling me. In the general course of conversation, this is how this kid is doing. These are the supports that I have found to be particularly effective for them and for me as their foster parent. And so that is what we mean by that. And if you ever feel a conversation or the guidance going towards the direction of the rules conversation, then I would encourage you to shift it back to the engagement and dialogue conversation, because that's what that is really meant to be about. The other thing that has seemed to be vastly confusing to people is different rules for different types of caregivers, right? Have you guys heard any terms related to that? Are you guys familiar with terms related to that? Good, don't be. Don't be, because I think they're only more confusing, really. So, there is when another foster parent does formal respite for you, right? That requires that they actually are a foster parent. There's some payment involved. That's your village work with another foster parent. There are people who you might call a babysitter, but who routinely, more than once a week, usually at designated same times, are providing care for your foster kids. So there's an ongoing, pretty frequent connection between those people. That type of caregiver we will want to be in dialogue about to have some base screening done. Not foster parent, full screening, you know, all the requirements to become a foster parent, but some basic screening, somebody that's going to have that ongoing, again, more than once a week, usually at designated times, primary caretaking relationship with the child. Everybody else is just how you would do it in normal life. And they don't have to be screened. And they don't have to be approved. So if your child is going on a sleepover at his friend's house, it's okay. If you are running late from work and you need your neighbor, who you interact with all the time and know well, to go and pick up your child, it's okay. If your child loves your parents and they have a swimming pool, I don't know, or whatever, they might want to go over to their house very spontaneously, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, I'm so glad, because I could be using a break. I could be doing some other things. It's okay. And so does that make sense, the shift in the stretch that we're attempting to make here? You're going about your daily life and routine with the people that you already know, and we already entrust you to be reasonable and prudent parents. I mean, if we didn't, certainly you wouldn't have the kids with you. So why would we attempt to micromanage the way that you navigate relationships and your child navigates relationships? There are some non-negotiables. But they're fairly few, actually. So you want to engage in some dialogue with your case management staff if your child is going to be having overnights that last more than two nights in a row, if they're going out of state or out of the country. We can't mess in terms of reasonable and prudent parenting with things like court-ordered visitation, sibling visits, or any other court-ordered activities that are going on. Can't change the discipline policy. And then we can't really do big and major things with their education. So that would be like changing schools, changing an IEP if your child happens to have one, anything like that. And then last but not least, some basic medical stuff, which I would not think any reasonable or prudent parent would ever be doing anyway, which would be to change the medication. If your child, you know, have your child take medication less frequently than prescribed, anything like that. And so those are the basics in terms of an overview. And I would love it if Leslie would come and help me take a deeper dive into what really would be helpful to you guys.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
You're doing such a great job. And you're left-handed.
Yes.
So you like it over here.
I like it over here.
I'm going to go over here, and I'm going to open up my iPad. Can I get a show of hands? How many people feel like they had some weight lifted in the last couple minutes, as she has described reasonable and prudent parent? Put them up high so we can see them. Awesome. How many people are still confused?
And that's okay.
And don't know what they can do?
Okay.
Okay. And how many people are like, hey, I was already doing it that way anyway? Great. Because the good news about that is, that's even a part of what has come to pass as we've talked about this, which is, people were already doing things that were much more natural and feeling like they were out of bounds. And it wasn't something that could have been policed to the level that it was trying to be policed anyway. So we're just moving toward sensible together, right?
We are.
Right.
And away from worst case scenario, that's what happens at the state office. We always see when something's gone really awry. Oftentimes, that's all we see. I really preach every day to my peers at the state office. Listen, what I need us to really keep in mind and believe is that 95% of the time, things are going just fine. Things are going just fine. This is true for our staff as well as you guys. And so we cannot operate from the place of the 5% where things have really gone astray.
Right, right. Okay, so I'm going to pull some questions that have come from the room, Tammy, and I'm going to kind of choose the order because I think some of them will help some of the people who are still looking for clarification. When, in 2015, when the first set of guidelines came out,
right,
there was a rule of three that kind of was a hang-on from history. And so now, for non-routine caregivers, for people who are not systematically watching the kids more than once a week, they don't have to wait and then the third time go do something.
Correct. You Nothing. Should erase any rule of three terminology from
yes.
your
forget
brains
the rule
if
of,
you can.
Forget the rule of three right now, forever. Because it's not relevant. It only the background checking that your agency will need to do becomes relevant when someone, and this is the way I like to think of it, when someone is coming into that child's story as a more consistent influencer over what's happening in that child's life. So a couple times a week starts to become a pretty significant amount of influence that person's having, and I think it's probably a good idea to make sure that that person is safe, right?
Right?
Okay. Does RPPS extend to birth families?
So what I would say about this is twofold. You have to understand what might be in court orders, case plans, and the division's safety planning for birth families, and then be in dialogue about what you would like to do. So it does extend in some ways, as long as the contact, everybody is on the same page, that it's appropriate contact. So I'll give you a good couple of examples, and if it's not enough, then we can dive into that deeper. if you desire to perhaps have you and your children pick up mom for visitation and have kind of an extended family experience of visitation, meaning you guys are all together, and then take mom home, or you guys take the kids to eat, or something like that. On that, I would run it by your DFACS worker, but in a sense, that's what we would want to see, right? The same applies for, I've mentioned, I think, Kelly's aunt. So you would want to know that the division had said, yes, Kelly's aunt is an appropriate person that we want Kelly to be able to spend time with. Here's the parameters that we currently have. You go forth within those parameters, and if you see through your developing relationship that there's something else you might want to do, then you say, hey, this is what I'd like to do next. Is this reasonable? Does that answer the question?
I think so. And I think what I'm hearing you say in the subtext of all this, too, is at the beginning of a placement, you're just getting to know the child. But as you get to know the child and what their family system consists of, if there are people in their family system that the case managers or the child have made you aware of that are determined to be good people, then all the better to continue to include existing relationships alongside the new relationships as a part of their village.
Right.
And that the case managers will kind of help you navigate whether or not there's anything that they feel they need to do in order to background check that person. But it's not your responsibility to decide that. It'll be on the case manager's side of things. Let's see here. If my supporting mentor through Fostering Together babysits every week while I go to small group, do they have to get background checked?
Once a week?
Once a week.
Nope.
Okay. Nope. And for those of you in the room that are supporting mentors or people who were formerly on our staff team or our staff team who have had to work through all of that paperwork for so many years, we're sorry, but we're also happy. It's over. It's over. If my parents keep my child overnight once a month, do they need to be screened?
No.
Okay. Does this count in any way as... No. Okay. That was just a no. Let's see what else. These are all kind of the same. We 100% want to protect our foster children, but we also want to provide them with the same experience as our biological children. We have a few, 16 and 17-year-olds in our life, who love all of our children and want to babysit for us, but they cannot because they are not 18, which means our foster children are missing out on a special part of our village. Is there any chance of this changing?
I think possibly. Actually, it's interesting that this comes up as a question because we had just had some dialogue about this recently. And what the dialogue came up because a county office was just like, this is completely fine. We completely can do this. So I think, yes, and on this particular one, I think it's heavily then dependent on child-specific situation, so mm-hmm. age of your child, all that kind of stuff, circumstances. But yes, I actually do think there's some flexibility.
So it's interesting here because what you're saying is that there's not a rule that says it could never happen.
Correct.
There's a rule that says it can always happen if they're over 18 and
Correct.
You're comfortable. If you're trying to navigate something that's outside that boundary, you're going to have a conversation and it's going to come down to this personal situation and the kids in that home and whether or not everybody agrees. No, they're capable, right?
Right.
Okay, that's awesome. Can routine caregivers, those mm-hmm. people who've had some background checks done, can they care for children more than two consecutive nights? What is the process for more than two consecutive nights?
They can?
They can. How many nights do they have to ask permission? What is the process?
So there's not
there?
A limitation on that particularly. I would say that if you... That's a good example. So your routine caregivers are actually going to be caring for the kids for a week or so because you guys are going out of town to do something else. So you probably want to let your case manager know about that. But beyond that, there's really flexibility. So if they're staying three nights, that's fine.
Right.
You know,
okay.
The out-of-state, out-of-country travel rules would apply. So if they happen to be going out-of-state, those rules
right.
would apply.
Right.
But really it eliminates that... Tiny eliminates the rule of three, right? I mean, reasonable and prudent. If you're going out of town for a week and your parents are caring for kids, the important people in the kids' lives would probably know that, right?
Right, right.
So it's reasonable and prudent. You would let somebody know that, but it's not prohibitive.
So this is another thing that I personally just love about this, and I think it's been a part of the texture of us as a church ministry, which is you guys seem to have gotten to the place now where you're looking at the relationship base of the child as a major decision criteria over who can take care of that child when the parents can't take care of that child, as opposed to some arbitrary other set of rules, which, frankly, you know, a stranger with the right approvals could never be better for a child when the parents are away than someone who they know. And so it's all moving in that direction. Now, Tammy, tell me honestly, how comfortable do you think the child placing agencies and DFACS workers out there today are with this shift that's just beginning to make its way forward?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we run quite a huge ship between DFACS and 159 counties and all of our employees and also our private partners and about that same number of people amongst all our private partners. So I would say in terms of the DFACS staff, it's like any other human experience. You have maybe 50% that are super comfortable, comfortable far beyond the rules that we probably have today. And you have 50% that are a little more feeling a need to be controlling. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say about that. Our private agencies, what I notice about our private agencies is So they operate as a business, right? So there's a second governmental entity called a residential child care licensing that gives them their business license. They also have lots and lots of rules and regulations. Those businesses get cited when errors to the policies are found. There are potential financial penalties. So some, I think, private agencies could be slightly slower to make the shift, mostly because they just want to hear us and our sister licensing agency say, no, you would not get sanctioned for this. I would also add, Leslie, that part of the intensive work that Leslie and I have done together is to try to alleviate many of those very concerns. We've spent long hours with our partners at residential child care licensing, kind of going through sentence by sentence. Would an agency get cited for this? Could there be a financial penalty for this? And so one of the things that we'll be doing, just so you guys are also aware, is taking every opportunity to kind of fully flesh out this same type of dialogue with all of our private agencies and our DFACS staff.
So in those conversations with the RCCL people, kind of a sticking point was, well, you know, what if my supporting mentor has gone out on an outing and the child gets injured? I mean, ultimately, the fear was substantial that the agencies would be cited for some sort of failure. In the current environment, however, what's going to happen is somebody's going to ask how the accident happened, what the process was for you knowing the person that was caring for the child when it happened, and if all of that looks reasonable, there's nothing, okay? So what I would say to you as a ministry director of this ministry is we are very intentional as an organization in terms of recruiting support for your families, and I apologize to those of you who are visitors here today who probably wonder, what's she talking about? We're very intentional about recruiting people to support you. And even though it's not required, we are running the checks that we run on every person who serves in any child ministry area of this church before we introduce them to you. But that becomes the beginning place for your relationship that leads to the answer to the question, the way in which you used them, was it reasonable and prudent? So you can't assume that just because they had the church background check and we've introduced them to you, that that is free rein to leave town next Saturday night and leave these kids with those people. That would not be wise. Nobody would think that was reasonable and prudent, right? You have to back up and build a relationship. So there's opportunity and responsibility in the intersection between our introduction of you to a congregation member who has said, I want to be in the story of this family. I want to help with the placement of this child. And the moment in time when you do an overnight, for sure, but even something simpler than that, you probably have to invest a little bit. You have to kind of be willing to make friends with these people and get to know them enough that you feel comfortable. So just know that as you take on additional supportive relationships, there's just that little bit of extra effort that you'll have to put in to create connection yourself and create a sense of belonging and relational meaningfulness so that you would comfortably say, no, using that person in my child's story was very reasonable. Anybody else in my circumstance would have done it the same way. That sound about right?
Yes.
Yes. So there's really not, it's, to me, this is groundbreaking because when the rules came out in 2015 and that sticky little rule of three was still in them, it was super sad to me because it meant that really nothing changed because you were still stuck, you know, with a very tough process of trying to get people approved to support you. And that should change things radically for us in terms of recruiting people and moving them from the enthusiastic moment that they've had when they've come to orientation into engagement with you. We've struggled for years now with losing people just in the muddiness of the process of trying to get them through those deeper approvals. So they'll be as safe as we know they are, and then you figure out from there how to build a relationship with them that makes you comfortable, that allows you to leverage them as broadly as possible because there aren't any limits. They can do transportation, they can do babysitting, they can do whatever you relationally decide is meaningful and helpful to you and that you're comfortable asking them to do. There's one question on here that's really specific, and I think I know the answer, but you're the state office lady, so you answer it. Is making a decision to hold a foster child back a grade in school part of the non-negotiables?
Yes.
Okay, so the educational landscape needs to be done in collaboration with your caseworkers and the court that is overseeing the case. Okay, I'm going to ask for another raise of hands. Who now feels like they understand what they're allowed to do with regard to supportive care for their children? Oh, that is beautiful. That is beautiful. I have one last question. You said earlier that foster families can use other foster families for, oh, that word, I hate that word, for respite. It's a messy word because it's got lots of meanings. As it relates to RPPS, say the Carpatas and the Turners know each other, and the Turners are going out of town for the weekend and they want the Carpatas to help them. What sort of, and it's casual, it's not paid respite. They're just being friends because they know each other. What needs to happen, if anything, related to that because they're both licensed foster homes?
Right. And so for something that is kind of unexpected or a couple hours or half a day or something, I really don't think a lot needs to happen. That it can be family to family. If you're thinking it's more like a weekend or longer term thing, then I think it's something that you probably just want to check in and let your agencies know. Now, there's a reason for that. And that is because along the lines of getting cited, every home, right, has some capacity limitations and approvals. And if that knocks your friends into overcapacity or something like that, then it could be a citation for that agency, and you would want your friends and their agency to have had dialogue about that beforehand.
So, but there...
Does that answer or not answer?
It does and it doesn't. So I'm sending my foster daughter to a sleepover at somebody's house who's not a foster family, right? Mm-hmm. And the kids are going to be sleeping all over the floor. And I'm comfortable with that, and the kids think it's fun. That can't happen in a foster home that's licensed by inviting another foster family's kids
in. I think it can happen. I do think it can happen. The reason that I'm saying on that one, I would maybe... And again, if we could make the switch from, like, approval to dialogue, mm-hmm. and by the we, I mean the collective we, right? So you guys, your agencies, and all that. Hey, just want to let you know, not... Hey, I want your approval. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's a great way to look at it, which is I just want to let you know this is happening.
Right.
Not, can I have your permission to do this? That's a sea change, right? Assuming that you're trusted in advance and how you communicate can communicate a lot. If you communicate from the posture of, I'm not trusted, I have to ask permission, you probably get somebody feeling like they need to tell you what to do. So work on that a little bit. Work on feeling more empowered and behaving more empowered as opposed to behaving more like you don't have the right or the responsibility or the freedom to make some of those decisions and see how it works out. And if you're having trouble, let us know because we can work on that. I think there was one other question, if my very old brain can recapture it. Can a respite, a home that's a respite family that's licensed with DFACS, provide respite for a child placing agency family that they're friends with? Is there anything in policy that bars that?
There is not.
Did you hear that? Okay. Does anybody want to stand up and applaud right now?
I know why.
I don't understand the question.
Agency and DFACS families that are friends with each other, and the DFACS home is willing to keep the agency kids for respite. There's no policy that bars that. Same. No policy that bars that. But I'm not telling you the floodgate just opened. I'm bringing this up so that you can understand there's tension in that, and to the extent that you need help with that tension, you have campus leads at your campuses and myself who are willing to help work on that with your agencies to try to get things moving in that direction. Again, the relationship with the child is the glue there. Like if there's already an existing relationship, we're not going to be suggesting a lot of crossover respite situations when there isn't a relationship benefit for the child. But where one of those exists, it's a worthy thing to go work on. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. I don't think I got any other new questions in here. And we're late finishing.
Oh, so, I'm sorry about that.
Yes. But I've hopefully this was rich and helpful to everybody in the room. So can you guys give Tammy a hand for being here today? And the last thing I'll say is we're not done yet, right? She thought maybe that there would be a point where we got this RPPS change behind us and then Leslie would set sail and go away, but we've decided to be friends and keep working together on some other things that are that could also get better over time, right?
Oh, yeah. You're a fantastic partner, so I'm eager to do that. And just let me say to you guys that really what I think the spirit of our state office around this, and certainly my genuine and heartfelt spirit, is that you guys are such the experts and that you need to be treated as such. And so hopefully this stretching will accomplish that. Because that is really like, I don't have long to retirement. If I could execute that as a climate and a culture, then my career would have been worth it. So thank you.
Okay, well, she's not retiring soon. So
I am.
No, you are not. Okay. Thanks, guys.